Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. This evening is Thursday, July 2nd, 2009, and I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. We're coming into the July 4th holiday, which is one of my favorite holidays, and it's a wonderful time to remind ourselves and celebrate the fact that freedom can and does win and does work. So a good time to be had at all. We're going to have a parade here in Hickory Valley, Tennessee, and that's where I'm going to be at on the town commons for the town parade. This evening is our second quarter wrap-up. I'd like to pause at the end of every quarter and the end of every year and take the long view. Where are we? How are we doing? And to brief you on what I see it means to us and where we need to focus our time and our resources over the next quarter. My theme tonight is surfing the slow burn. We put up a blog post we do every week to support the Soleri Report, and I describe again what the slow burn is. It's my vision of an economy that's very controlled, where the insiders manipulate a variety of different financial and governmental and other systems to really subsidize themselves at the expense of the outsiders. And one of the most telling things about the second quarter is I have known and worked with for many years people who had a real good sense of what was really going on and have worked to try and understand the slow burn and the economy, and in the process have really taken action over many years to try and protect themselves. And we really saw that effort work this quarter. We saw people who've taken the actions to really move away from centralized systems and move away from a lot of the political risk. And for me, it was very gratifying to really start to see a growing group of people, not yet a critical mass, but getting to critical mass of people who've repositioned themselves and they're navigating the changes underway. And so it was a reminder to me that it really is worth understanding the real deal, although sometimes that can be an unpleasant task. So despite all of the change and the shock around us, something very positive is happening. And the more of us who go through that change, the more people there are to collaborate with. So something within everything going on, there's something very positive. So I had a vision of a surfer kind of surfing this big wave, and the wave is going, and you kind of think, oh, but the surfer somehow manages to surf the wave. Money and markets, let me say a few things before we start the wrap-up. The most important story to me this week was one that you rarely saw even mentioned in corporate media, and that was the Foreign Banks and Financial Accounts form, which is a form filed with the U.S. Treasury by individuals who have foreign bank accounts. In early June, the IRS started notifying tax practitioners, mostly attorney and accountants and people who prepare tax forms and advise individuals on tax matters. The IRS started to inform them in a variety of ways, both at conferences and a series of statements, including sort of revising instructions through their frequently asked questions on their website, that there was going to be a real shift and focus on enforcement in this form and a shift in who was or what qualified as a financial institution. So investment vehicles and companies that no one ever thought related to this form or were covered by this form suddenly are starting to get umbrellaed. And in a very confusing way, because these are issues that tax preparers have different opinions on. We posted two blog posts on the topic, so I'm not going to go through it because it gets pretty detailed and granular pretty quickly, and so if it doesn't apply to you, it's not a good use of your time. But it's in combination with a series of other actions that have been taken by the U.S. government, particularly the tax treaty with Switzerland, that's been behind the scenes such a big brouhaha this spring. What we're seeing is the beginning of major financial and legal headaches for many Americans who've had significant assets offshore, particularly if they've had them offshore for a long time or they have not paid their taxes in full. And And this doesn't just apply to people who are quote-unquote tax evaders. This applies to people who, who've had things offshore and maybe it hasn't been impeccable, or they've had it offshore and they wanted it to be private. Because the loss of privacy is very significant. You're talking about asking very private people to send forms through the U.S. mail that have not only their account numbers but their social security numbers on it. And that data is going to be aggregated by large corporate defense contractors in an environment which I would describe as somebody, as a governmental official who oversaw big information systems of this kind in government, I would say it's an unbelievably insecure environment. And we've seen plenty of examples of databases like this, both at the big banks and government, sort of being lost and disappearing. So for people as private as this, it's a pretty shocking process to go through. If you look at that in combination with the losses we've seen in the equity markets, $60 billion loss on Madoff, which is a, you know, that's a lot of people, and now what I would call sneaky capital controls, the wealthier, the American wealthy are getting hit very hard by the realization that wealth doesn't necessarily qualify you as an insider in what some people call the New World Order. So we're seeing wealthy Americans going from a state of financial security and safety to a state of legitimate concern about where things are headed. The immediate explanation from the industry is that the IRS is doing this because they need revenues. And while I think that's part of the issue, I don't think it's the primary reason. What we're watching, on one hand, you're watching a variety of withdrawals from the U.S. banking and brokerage system, partly as a shock from just the state of corruption and the poor performance. As that's happening, one of the things that's been happening is Americans have been investing their capital directly abroad. So rather than putting their money in a U.S. bank and mutual fund that then invests abroad, they invest directly. What forms like this does is encourage Americans to instead go through U.S. financial institutions. So it's a great mechanism to force more capital into the very institutions who some of us are drawing away from. So think of it as a kind of a sneaky backdoor capital control. Second, obviously, it's a shift from a democratic government to one where there's much more top-down control, because financially independent people tend to be ornery, stand up to government. Everybody knows my story. You know, I could litigate with the federal government because I had $6 million to spend in doing so. Anyway, so you control people's money and they become much more obedient. One of the questions we got from a subscriber was whether or not we thought the foreign financial institution filing would affect gold money. There's some debate about whether gold money is applicable. Gold money became a money services business in April of 2008 when it started to allow holdings to be converted into currencies, and it now provides access to a wide variety of different currencies. That money services status increases the chances that a tax preparer would advise that it would be applicable. And my guess is that the impact on their business is going to be to shift them incrementally more towards European and Asian customers. It's for any company outside of the U.S., dealing with American investors is becoming more and more difficult just because of the regulatory and risk issues. I mean, we've seen a whole variety of Swiss banks basically tell people if your account is less than a certain amount of money, basically probably accredited investor across the board or qualified investor, just goodbye, take your money and go home. So it's becoming more expensive for all these institutions to deal with Americans. And so I think incrementally you're going to see companies like Gold Money shift more to Europe and Asia, number one. But I also think that because of this kind of regulatory discomfort and risk, you're going to see many more Americans shift incrementally to prefer physical possession of precious metals as opposed to digital gold or ETF. So in my mind, gold money is still very attractive, but it does mean you have to file a form. And it's just one more thing to do. So as the I think the net bottom line on all of this is as the distrust of the U.S. financial system increases, here people are going to start withdrawing from the system and, you know, and having to work through the system. And so that's my guess as to where this thing is going. Another thing that happened, I think, not as important but certainly more public, was a very funny Rolling Stone article on Goldman Sachs called The Great American Bubble Machine. And it's quite extraordinary. Rolling Stone must be under immense pressure because they didn't put it up on their website. Despite its popularity, all sorts of people have created various copies and put them up, and I've linked several times from the blog to them. One of the things it does is it makes the numbers very clear on the Goldman Sachs bailout, and I posted an article called Shock Doctrine Part 5, Shock Doctrine California Part 5 today, and some of the numbers I'm going to run through are described in that post. But basically, here's what it says. Last year, speaking of tax evasion, Goldman Sachs, can you believe this, only paid $14 million in taxes to the U.S. government last year. Now, that was the year in which the government gave them $13 billion through the AIG bailout. So they were just gifted. Can you imagine being gifted $13 billion? And then they lent them $10 billion through the TARP program, which they've subsequently paid back, as well as giving them authority to use the FDIC credit to raise capital, which means if you're paying, you know, 20 to 36% on your credit card, if you got to use the FDIC credit to you know, if you could offer your creditors the FDIC credit card, your borrowing rate would be, you know, probably 2% today on your credit card. So, you know, so that's an incredible benefit for somebody who's in the markets as much as Goldman Sachs. They used the taxpayers' money to pay bonuses to their employees of $4.7 billion. So if we gifted them $13 billion through the AIG bailout, then their private employees got about $4.7 billion. At one point, somebody estimated that their employees are going to make this year an average of $700,000 per employee. Of that amount, their CEO got $42.9 million, which means the CEO got three times what the U.S. government got in taxes. So you can imagine, you know, the IRS is going after all these relatively, you know, wealthy but powerless individuals, but leaving Goldman Sachs alone. So what does this all mean? I want to look at this in the context of the California budget crisis. The California budget deficit is approximately $24 billion. And if you count that up, it's basically less than Goldman Sachs got in gifts and loans. If you look at some of the other backdoor gifts and loans that Goldman got, I think it's probably less even than what they probably got gifted. Now, what we're saying is we can afford to spend $24 billion to basically give to and support one of the leading institutions which engineered the housing bubble, in fact, made a lot of money shorting the housing market, helping to facilitate the housing crash. So here we have the perpetrators of a financial crisis. We're gifting them an amount of money approximately equivalent to what California needs to balance their budget. But we're telling California so far, and I think it's too early to tell what's going to happen, but we're telling California so far kind of, you know, go jump in a lake. Now, what that means is we can afford to use taxpayers' money to pay some people $700,000 per year per person when literally we're going to take a series of actions in California and other states that will leave children homeless and without health care. Now, the fact of the matter is not only is this going on, but it's going to get clearer and clearer. I've recommended several times in the Solari Report that if you have the time, you read Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine. It's a description of sort of these kinds of shock techniques and centralization of wealth quickly in Latin America. And it's good because she really goes through the intentionality of it, the sort of coordination between foundations, universities, governments in a way that's quite shocking, the impact on the population. And the value of reading it is to really help you see what is being sort of what's going to play out at the state and local level. And the question remains is whether it will be done here in a more subtle or nicer way. But we're seeing more and more signs that we're really headed into a shock doctrine kind of situation. In 2004, California had a $38 billion deficit that suddenly quietly disappeared. We never quite learned, you know, how it came about. I've always suspected there was sort of a backdoor bailout from the federal government, not only to California, but some of the other states. So we have yet to see if something like that could happen. If it does, this conversation is delayed for another time, and the changes will be more subtle. If it isn't, then we're in for some dramatic changes, not just the changes that will roll out in California, the other states, but the changes as people realize that we're not watching this because there's not enough money. We're watching this happen because we're shifting vast resources to a few people, not based on any economic performance or worthiness, but simply because they have the power to take it. And as that realization goes through society, we're going to see some changes. Okay, second quarter 2009. My theme tonight again is surfing the slow burn. I think I've never seen the rate of change go the way it's gone the last 3 months. I just we try at the Solari team to keep the blog updated and stay current on what's going on and make sure our network knows. And I'm just dazzled at how fast things are moving. And really what's happening is that many of the things that are now happening and are obvious to many people have been happening behind the scenes for years. And so one way I would say it is the financial coup d'etat that's been going on for more than a decade is finally beginning to look more and more obviously like a real coup. I wanted to start by reviewing the areas of opportunity that I used to describe in the audio seminar, Position Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times. And I just want to stress again, we have two pieces that really cover the question I get asked the most is, what can I do, what can I do? And Coming Clean, which you can access from the homepage, and then Position Your Assets for Growth, really go through both your personal life and your financial life and lay out sort of what are the actions you can consider and take that will help you get to the point where you're surfing the slow burn too. So I would really encourage you to use those as tools. But let me go through the what I described as the areas of opportunity in Position Your Assets and sort of look at what performed during the second quarter this year. Category number one was personal self-sufficiency, which I would say was was the all-star performer in both the first and second quarter, and was really at the heart of learning to surf the slow burn. And really, when I say personal self-sufficiency, I don't mean going off into the woods and eating beans and doing everything yourself. I mean getting out of dependency on strangers, and particularly strangers in large systems, and getting into depending on yourself and the people you know and trust. So a lot of that comes about by building personal network and getting in cahoots with people who are good at things you're not good at. But let's just go through a couple of areas, because even though this is not necessarily an area of big financial investment, it is an area of big time investment. This is an area where it takes time. There's a lot to learn, and you want to organize it so it's a learning journey that's energizing for you. It's fun for you. But it does take time, and so it's one to think of. One of the things I encourage everyone to do, and which I do, is I try and do every year a time budget and look at the sources and uses of my time and really think about, okay, how can I change how I invest my time that will improve my skills and knowledge and my network to be much more self-sufficient? So let me give you a couple examples. Simplify. Reduce debt and overhead. As those of you who used to know me, I used to have a, for my business and my and my personal life, I had $1 million a month overhead. Well, needless to say, it's much, much, much lower. And I do everything I can to keep, you know, to keep it as low as I possibly can. So reduce debt and overhead, and try and keep your expenses in a non-corporate kind of infrastructure. Stockpile. I really believe if you look at the yields that you get on money markets and the yields that you get on CDs or just having money in a checking account, and you look at it on an after-tax basis, it's almost nothing. So at the same time, if you stockpile a year or two of the non-perishables you need and the prices are inflating at 3-4%, you're not going to have to pay taxes on those capital gains. And more important, you won't have risk. So think about how you can start to shift your money into the tangibles that you really need and use. Finally, just a lot of this is investing time in the skills that you need to do more for yourself. And, of course, what you do really depends on what you like to do. But if I stress one thing coming into this fall and the third quarter, the third and fourth quarter are going to be periods. Let's say everybody, all the state and local governments get bailed out and the slow burn continues. The shock doctrine, the shock and all here is much more subtle. We're still going to have tremendous amounts of failure in systems. Let me give you an example. We're at record bankruptcies. We're at record foreclosures. We're at record unemployment. We're going to be part of a middle class that's going through significant financial challenges, and that brings personal and emotional stress. It's going to be all around us, no matter how well we're sort of surfing the slow burn. In addition, we've got state and local government, even with bailouts, under tremendous pressure because they built up large infrastructures for a bubble economy that is no more. So in that scenario, this is a period in which our time is going to get called on in ways that we didn't expect. I'll give you a perfect example. When the information came in about the change in trend and direction by the IRS on the financial forms, I took one look at this and said, you know, this is going to cost our team in the next 2 weeks 50 hours that we hadn't budgeted on. So, you know, those things are going to keep on happening. And so anything you can do to budget extra time to protect yourself is invaluable. And to make sure anytime you can get an institution or person out of your life which is who's unreliable or you can't trust, it radically reduces your risk in this kind of environment. Last thing, and I'm going to talk a little bit about swine flu later, but we really need to get radical about our health. Laura Thompson was on the Solaria Report. You can access that interview in the archive if you hadn't listened to it. But we talked a lot about steps to get your immune system high and your toxicity low, and that is so, so, so important. Your health is... I see so many people in this environment trying to solve their rising risk by making more money or finding more money or worrying more about money. And what we all need to understand is the risks we're dealing with in many cases cannot be solved with more money. And that takes me to the second area of opportunity, which is family, community, and networks. Now, this is a conundrum for a lot of people because many of us, we're not close to our family, or we don't know our neighbors, or we live in a place where there's not a lot of interest in building communities or improving self-sufficiency. So a lot of what you can do depends on where you are, or whether or not you want to move to a place where that's more community-oriented. But the thing I want to stress is it's really important to start. And the best place to start is with food and water. There, wherever you are, there are community-supported agriculture. The numbers on gardening is unbelievable. Gardening is not a business, which is down. It's way, way up. It's one of the few industries that's up a lot. I just saw a presentation by one of the government technology centers here in Tennessee predicting that the number one source of green jobs was going to be organic farming and farming. You see farmers markets developing all over. And so there's a lot more organization going on, whether city, suburb, or rural area in the food area. So to me, one of the best ways to hook into your community is starting to find the ways of sourcing the local food systems. Because one of the things that's happening, we're watching a huge rush of massive, complex legislation coming through Congress at terrifying speed. It really at a speed where no congressman or the staff can even read the bill. The energy bill was up to 1,200 pages when I last looked. But we've had a food safety bill come through the House to the Senate, which is truly shocking and really horrible. And if you take a look, there's a blog post on the food safety bill, but if you take a look at what's happening, what you realize is there are controls being placed on the food system, and of course safety is being used as an excuse, when in fact the thing that makes our food system safe is decentralization. But we're seeing laws and regulations put into effect that are going to make it more and more expensive and harder to access good quality food. And that means it's very important to build those relationships and networks locally. So I would really say start with food. Disaster preparedness, we've talked about disaster preparedness on prior Solari reports, but one of the things to think about is if Katrina happened, could you get out of your house quickly with what you need? Would you have the documents you need, et cetera? Another is swine flu. If you had to, could you shut your door and live for a month, in a way that was comfortable and made sense for you? So think about how to increase that self-sufficiency both in your own home, but personally. One of the things we saw in the second quarter, there's a lot of interest in local investment or in the kind of equity investment that could help build community, but it's still early, and it's very hard. It's complex for people to grapple with without a critical mass. The other thing is we're still watching a lot of bubble yet to come out of the stock market and the real estate market. A lot of questions about will it or it won't. And as long as asset prices appear relatively high to where they may go in the next 12 to 18 months, people are loath to invest, and that's pretty understandable. But when it comes to your strategic resources, it's not just an investment, it's strategic resources. So that's the place to begin. It's slow, but expect it to grow. Third area is banking intimate. We just had a wonderful Solari report with two bankers from the bank that Solari and I use, and talked about how to find a good local bank. Up on our website, we have a link. It says Bank Intimate, and we'll take you to a section that will walk you through how to find a good local bank. And we have an audio seminar also on how to find a local bank and other resources. But it's clearly, this is an environment where it pays to know your banker and have your banker know you. And there's a lot, if things are going to happen at a local level, there's a lot of local investment that could come out of, having the right banks and the right relationships locally. So we keep encouraging you to do. It's hard. The reports we get from our network indicate that the good, strong local banks are getting an increased flow of deposits, but it's hard to get statistics that confirm that. So it will be interesting to see what plays out in the third and fourth quarter. One of my concerns is the municipal bond market. If we do get Martin Weiss, who's a banking analyst, has predicted that California will default on its general obligation bonds, which are about $59 billion, so approximately the same amount as the Madoff, although Madoff lost 100%. If we see that, a municipal bond market default or a ripple through the municipal bond market could hit the banks, hit the smaller banks who have those bonds in portfolios. So that's just a thing to watch out for. Okay, fourth area, precious metals. Precious metals is continuing to behave very strongly like an alternative currency. And so we've seen between 2004 and now, we've really seen a lot more confidence grow that precious metals can behave and will behave like a precious metals. To me, July is a very important time. We've literally come through a period where we've bestowed the equivalent amount on the U.S. banks to the amount that, or let me say it another way, from the Revolutionary War until approximately 2 years ago, the United States had accumulated a total of $12 to $14 trillion in debt. In a year and a half, we bestowed that amount of money on the U.S. banks in the form of gifts or loans, and they now have an amazing war chest. Now, we're coming into a very big Russian summit, as well as a big G8 meeting, and we know from watching the president's regulatory proposals for the financial system, really revamping the financial system, we're looking to go through a process where we much more integrate U.S. governmental structures and regulation with international. We're looking to harmonize, you know, and this is all sort of part of the shift to one global government. And so Obama is leaving the United States, going, you know, we're going to a European process, and a lot of things could come out, a major shift could come out of this. One that would keep the dollar very strong for another period. We know the long-term trend on the dollar is down, but right now the dollar is the reserve currency. There's no alternative hanging in the winds, and there's a lot that could happen both within the United States in deals with Russia or China that could keep the dollar high for quite some time. It's had quite a run for the last 2 years. So I think one of the big questions in my mind, I expect significant pressure coming out of G8 to push precious metals down and to hold the dollar up. At the same time, if you look at the fundamentals of what we're coming into in the fall, I think, you know, whether that succeeds or not, it may turn out to be one of the last buying opportunities for precious metals if it happens, because the upward pressure on precious metals this fall will be significant, not just because of the tremendous deficits in this country, but literally a lack of confidence by a wide variety of people in the financial system. I put a, you know, sometimes I hear people tell me, Americans don't know what's going on, they're not paying attention, et cetera, et cetera. And I put up a little post called Bailout Math, which proves to me more than anything that the American people are very clear what is going on and are moving to take action. There were some estimates flying around the internet about how many guns people have bought in the last year or so and what the current level of ammunition purchase was. And so I calculated, just this is very gross back of the envelope, that the banks got $12 trillion and Americans pulled enough money out of their bank and brokerage accounts to buy $12 billion of ammunition rounds and 12 million guns, which means for every $1 million that the bankers got, Americans bought one gun and 10,000 rounds of ammunition, which says something about the perception of Americans about what's going on. So I think the need for an alternative currency is going to push precious metals up in the fall, and I think we're going to begin to see a shift, well, we're seeing it now, preference for physical possession instead of ETFs or that you can do through your brokerage account or digital gold. Now, we have the precious metals market report with Franklin Sanders next week, so more on precious metals next week. The next area of opportunity is natural resources, and natural resources is an area which clearly is a long-term trend. We have 6 billion people and growing on planet Earth, and the trick is how can we do more with less? Now, it's unnerving if you're looking at being an investor in natural resources, because we have an enormous deflationary trend happening despite all the printing of money. It's what I would call demand destruction. So as unemployment rises, as the economy slows down, what we're watching is the demand for natural resources in the short run is dropping. We've just seen a carbon trading program in the energy bill, part of the 1,200 pages, making its way through Congress. It is a terrifying bill. I posted something called The Next Scary Bubble on the blog, and I'm not going to go into carbon trading in detail on during the wrap-up, but this is in effect something that could become bigger and much more horrible than the derivatives markets, and sets into framework a global taxation system, starting in the United States, a taxation system that ultimately, if it evolves the way I expect it to, will allocate resources through a very negative incentive system, which will be massively unfair. The poor will not be able to game it. The Goldman Sachses of this world will be able to game it in a frightening way. So this is not a pleasant picture, but one of the things it can do is result ultimately in a lot of demand destruction. And so if you're trying to understand what's going to happen to the price of natural resources, certainly in the short run it's iffy. One of the things I expect in the third quarter is we're going to see the commercial real estate market potentially really hit a wall, and if state and local governments go through the shock doctrine, especially with the banks having big war chests of money, we're going to see a real effort to pick up land and prime real estate for cheap, including privatization. I've talked before about the state parks and my concern that a lot of the local and state parks and land is going to be in play over the next 2 years, and I think that's the case. But prices could head down for a while unless inflation turns them around. The next area of opportunity is countries with a strong popsicle index. This is still the case. We've seen countries that really have a culture of lawfulness and sort of caring for people be both attractive both to people and money, particularly if they're financially sound. I think that's all part of why Wall Street wants more and more capital controls, because money's tending to flow out of places that have more central control into places which are more respectful of people. So now, these places, the places that attract capital are not include states with budget problems. I go back to what Martin Weiss said about a default for California. Now, it's funny, it didn't get that much press, but I spent some time when I was in Wall Street doing special projects in the municipal bond area, and it's important to understand that if we get a real shock doctrine going in the state and local area, that the hit on family and household wealth could be as great in the municipal bond market as it's been in the stock market and the real estate market, because you're talking about because individuals buy tax-exempt bonds, got some banks and some insurance companies, it's a very important part of family wealth, and certainly for families who wanted to have money very conservatively managed. We saw a big hit earlier in sort of the financial crisis when the municipal bond insurers ran into trouble, and that hurt values a lot. And the markets come back from that surprisingly well. But a California default and real state and local government problems could hit those places hard and dramatically raise the cost of capital in a way that gets you spiraled down. The second last area was enterprises that own or are excellent at the variety of things we're talking about and clean technology, infrastructure in essential areas. Now, the clean energy bill is going to do somewhat of a boom. It's a lot of money throwing at some of these areas. But I think we have a lot of shakeout to go through. So there's a wonderful Solari report with John Rubino, who's the author of Clean Technology, a very good book and oversight. I do think there's going to be a lot of opportunity in this area, but we still have PE levels that are way above, or stock market levels that are way above trading levels that we've seen in other recessions and depressions, and we have a growing perception in the financial community worldwide of sort of rigged markets, naked short selling, and different kinds of corruption in the financial system, particularly the U.S. financial system. So those two things could play out and make someone like me very skittish about the stock markets right now. The final area was cash and cash equivalents and strong currencies. Honestly, there's no such thing as a strong currency these days. The strongest currency right now is the dollar, and we know that the dollar is not based on fundamental economic grounding. It's based much more on force. There's a lot of prediction and very eloquent predictions about hyperinflation and collapse. And while those scenarios are possible, they're not necessary at all. The system does not need to collapse. The dollar has a lot more staying power, in my opinion, particularly if the social safety net, private property, and the population in the U.S. is significantly diminished. My biggest concern is we have a president who's built up very significant political capital internationally. And yet he's unbelievably close and supportive of the banks. And so we're literally watching a political situation unfold where a president loyal to the banks can engineer political support globally for jamming it to the American middle class. Now, I'm not saying that it's going to happen. I think July and this summer will tell us a lot, but if you ask me, to me, the American middle class is politically in a very vulnerable position. And because I feel that way, I published on the blog a piece that I wrote describing that sort of political conundrum. It's called Faith and the Way Forward. And I would encourage you to take a look at it because I think we're coming into a dangerous situation. If you look at... we might not all be familiar with the acronym BRICS. BRICS stands for Brazil, Russia, China, and India. I got that wrong, India and China. But it's basically the economies which have young populations and are growing and expected to do very well economically over the next, the next 10 or 20 years. What the BRICS have been doing, and we've posted the stories about this up on the blog, what the BRICS have been doing is making all sorts of arrangements to trade among themselves and directly without having to go through the reserve currency, through the dollar. And now, that's a kind of change that's more slow and subtle than the dollar collapsing tomorrow, but you're starting to see more and more countries make provision to operate in and around the system. You know, it's the same... As we and the BRICS make our provision to go around the system, you know, Wall Street and the government then send out financial forms that try and force the money back in. So we have this sort of economic warfare where the money is pulling out and they're trying to force it back in. And just as we watch China wander around the world and lock up natural resources, or China and the other BRICS find ways of trading around the system, you know, that's an example to you and me as to what we ought to be doing, whether it's figuring out where our natural resources, you know, our food and water is going to come from, and figuring out how we can start to operate in and around the system and not be a prisoner of the system. So anyway, on currencies, the long-term trend is clear. The dollar's headed down, but I think it's going to be a managed process, not to say we shouldn't be prepared for a real crash. If we get a real crash, then it's going to be a very chaotic time. And for those of you who are interested, we did Solari reports with Dmitry Orlov and Cliff High to kind of walk through what those scenarios could look like. Now, I got two questions on the currency issue. One was, did I foresee a gold-backed currency? And my answer is unlikely. We have in the United States a leadership which is firmly committed to fiat currency. And there's a lot more value they can wring from that currency because a fiat currency is, in essence, a global taxation system. We give people dollars or sell them treasury securities. They go down in value, and that's what finances us. And so I think the incentive to keep the fiat currency going as long as possible is there. Now, you definitely have groups among the leadership that would love to use precious metals and have found money for a variety of reasons, both positive and negative. And we're seeing real increased interest in using gold and silver coins as currency. I posted several articles. We're seeing vending machines pop up in Germany and planned, I think, for the UK in Europe, where literally you walk up to the vending machine, put in your money, and out pops your gold bar. So that's a clear sign of interest in sort of retail purchasing. One of the things we've been doing at Solari is working on the silver and gold calculator and turning it into an iPhone app, just because we've gotten so many requests to, you know, make it more accessible to people as they wander around. So I think there's going to be, you know, there's something percolating, and there are a lot of different scenarios where if we get into a situation where we can't use the dollar, there's a bank holiday, whatever, it wouldn't surprise me to see gold and silver pop up as the community currency of choice. You don't need to get together. You don't need to agree. You just need to just do it. It's kind of the Nike thing. Another question was currency devaluation. Could we see that? My guess is yes, we could, but it wouldn't be so much a currency devaluation as a gold revaluation. You go to bed one night and gold's at, you know, 950, and you wake up the next morning and it's 3500, and they've managed through the process to wipe out, you know, all the debt. So that could happen. I think it's unlikely to happen this year, but that kind of overnight currency devaluation could be one way to handle the fact that there's a lot more paper than there are real things. So that's the seven areas of opportunity. Let me just quickly look at eight key events in the second quarter. Number one, Obama. The thrill is gone. Obama's still got doing well in the polls in terms of sort of general support. If you look at the support for his economic positions, it's much weaker. Unemployment is high and rising. The official statistics are significantly underestimating unemployment and underemployment. If we do get real cutbacks in state and local government, the unemployment is going to skyrocket. The commercial real estate cutbacks are coming. Those are going to be breathtaking. So as that happens, and the stark relief of the absence of bailouts to people and sort of the war chest to the bankers, and the bankers start spending that war chest, we're going to see the polls change, is my expectation. I notice today in Money Investing in the Wall Street Journal, Wall Street pay approaches 2007 records. So there's an extraordinary comeback in compensation so far this year, and it's talking about how the banks are doing well and are buying up lots of talent. Again, as I said before, the banks have the war chest, so they want to buy talent because they're going to come in for the kill, is my prediction. It's exactly what happened in 1989. So I think the bloom is going to be off the rose, and it's going to come off more. That this is all part of changing from a paradigm where we're looking for someone to save us to literally realizing that the problems are deeper than that, and we're going to have to save ourselves. So watch things, watch the take on Obama and the administration to change over the next, particularly the next 6 months. The second kind of event is 401k uh-ohs. As those of you who know me, I'm extremely concerned about the rules or changes in the rules about 401ks, IRAs, and other tax-managed accounts. There were some more trial balloons. I put them up on the blog and noted them as sort of 401k problems. There are more trial balloons indicating the quote-unquote desirability of moving to a system which is subsumed in something like the Social Security system. And as far as I'm concerned, it's just pure confiscation, what's being hinted at. And so there's nothing to do but to continue to watch it. But it's an uh-oh, and it's something I'm concerned about in the third and fourth quarter. Protecting yourself from the state and local budget squeeze. This is important. How do I describe it? Over the last 15 to 20 years, both federal, state, and local government have become much more dependent on what I would call for-profit activities. For-profit activities are fines, civil money penalties, seizures, and forfeitures. They are governmental actions that raise money. And appropriation committees, for example, with the federal government, will basically say to some of these agencies, the more money you generate from litigation, from fines, from various enforcement actions, the more generous we will be with your appropriation. So they have literally become, been shifted into a model of Sheriff of Nottingham. They are expected to make money through the enforcement activity. And I dealt in a process with the Department of Housing and Urban Development where literally they were not concerned about whether they were obeying the law. I mean, literally they were racketeering. And you had people enforcing in a way that literally they would come in and say, look, you can pay us to go away if you give us this amount of money. And we don't really care whether this is the law or not, but we have the power to basically blackmail you, and or it's called greenmail, to greenmail you, so give us the money. Now, a lot of this happens in ways that are nowhere near as dastardly as that. We all know, I live in the South, and of course there are towns that are designated speed traps. And, lo and behold, the poor troopers or sheriff people or the police have a quota, and they've got to give out so many parking tickets, or speeding tickets a month to make their budget. So throughout society, we're going to have all sorts of federal, state, and local government agencies looking for more ways to generate revenues through fines. As all these bills go through Congress, they're all going to be full of fines and civil money penalties and all this kind of stuff. Now, what does that mean to you? It's exceptionally important to be a little bit more careful than some of us are used to not being the targets of this kind of behavior and not expecting it. It's really important to think very carefully from everything from speeding tickets to being impeccable. Maybe it's time to get a tax preparer if you do your own taxes, or compliance with paperwork. This is a time to be very, very diligent and very, very careful, not take on a lot of regulatory risk. If you find yourself in a situation where you're the target of somebody's interest in this area, you want to take it very seriously. I'll give you a perfect example. There was a story of a San Diego pastor and his wife who'd been having Bible class with about 14 people in their home, and the county basically approached them and insisted they get a license, which is very expensive, before they could hold such a gathering in their own home. Sounds absurd. But the times they are changing. And so this is a period where you want to be very cautious. Depending on where you live, if there's an opportunity for you to get to know your local government officials and your sheriff or your community policing effort, now in a positive manner you want to do so, because you want to have people you can communicate with in case there's any understanding or if you need them. Another problem we're going to have with state and local cutbacks is the police on the beat are going to be either a lot less people or under much more stress. So lines of communication are going to be unbelievably important. All of those bureaucracies are filled with very good-hearted, hard-working, wonderful people who are being put under a lot more stress as well. So anything we can do to have a positive communication will help. Scam Watch. Green participatory budgeting, carbon trading, and social innovation. You have so many people who've wanted to see the economy decentralized and wanted to see real solutions to our abuse of natural resources, and they've come up with hundreds of wonderful ideas, which we are now in danger of seeing misused in many terrible ways. I put in my financial ecosystem blogs, I address sort of the misuse of participatory budgeting. In the next scary bubble, I talked about the misuse of carbon trading. I have a post called Stimulus or Economic Hit that gets into sort of the misuse of some of these and links to all of the examples I put up on the blog. The worst one I've ever seen was the very wonderful Kauffman Foundation was sent into Detroit with an entrepreneurship program. It was highlighted I was in the gym, and it was highlighted on CNN that the Kauffman Foundation was going into Detroit to create jobs, and it was an entrepreneurship program, and the administration estimated that they were going to get 25,000 jobs, and you just wanted to hiss and spit, because what Detroit has needed for 20 years is, for the same players to stop bringing in narcotics trafficking, to stop working the place over with mortgage fraud, to stop playing the games on the auto industry that they've played and resulted with the horror that we've watched. I've seen, known, heard of dealers all over the country who had highly profitable standalone businesses, literally had their businesses destroyed and ripped out from under them. So if you look at the amount of small business we're destroying by pulling, the banks are flush with cash. They're getting ready to come in for the kill, but they're not lending. Small business is getting their credit cut all over the country is what we're hearing. So what you're seeing is a game of economic warfare, and while small business is being intentionally devastated by a whole variety of very intentional forces coming from the top, they're taking a tiny bit of money and trickling in this sort of token effort and making it look like they really care about entrepreneurship. And the hypocrisy behind it is stunning. And the effect of it is crazy making, because if you're a busy person trying to raise a family, trying to run a business, and you kind of see, the federal government really cares about entrepreneurship. Look at this wonderful thing they're doing in Detroit. And you're a dealer who's just had your business and your family capital wiped out by a very dirty political game. It's those kinds of things make people crazy. Okay, New World Order Summer Watch. As I mentioned before, we have the Russian summit and the G8 meeting coming up next week. Following that, we have the Bohemian Grove coming together outside of San Francisco in July and early August. The Grove is a time when a lot of decisions get made that are very important to what happens in this country. So those decisions get made, and then people come out. Congress comes back in September and forges the new budget by October 1. So those dates and events, I think, are going to tell us a lot. And, of course, again, the big swing is what's going to happen with the state and local workouts. And will the system holder come apart? One of the big symptoms that the system might not hold and might come apart is something we saw happen. We've been seeing it happen a while, but we certainly had a beautiful example at the end of the second quarter, and that was Governor Sanford of South Carolina gets what I call Spitzered. I put a series of posts up about Elliot Spitzer's being targeted for his extracurricular sexual activities. We're seeing the same thing happen to Governor Sanford. I could theorize on why they're after Governor Sanford, but basically what you're seeing is in this sort of game of musical chairs, the elite pulling the chairs out from under each other. You're watching infighting and sort of factions competing, and it's going to get ugly. I mean, it's ugly now, but it's going to get much uglier. If you watch it, what Sanford's going through, that's the kind of thing that can kill people. It can kill families. It's pretty ugly. Now, you could say, well, he had an extracurricular affair. If you want to go through the personal lives of most people in leadership positions in this country, sounds to me like Sanford's cleaner than most. So whatever it's about, it's got nothing to do with sex. But watch for more of this. If the state and budgets go forward, if we get big municipal bond defaults and real drops in prices in that area, and it's clear that the banks have stockpiled and the administration has permitted them to build a war chest and have a free-for-all, they're going to be significant dangers, I think, to the leadership. And I'm kind of shocked at the every indication is that they don't realize it. So this is not a good time. If you're considering an appointment to a high-level cabinet position, this is the time to take a pass and maybe do something much more low-key and on the fringes. Another symptom to watch for is swine flu. The reality is that something like swine flu is one of the best devices there is to get to take 300 million people who are angry and starting to take action and scare them to death and get them to be obedient. The Bloomberg reports that the administration is stockpiling enough vaccine for everyone in America. There's a big discussion of whether they're going to have doctors administer it or states. But we run the risk this fall if we decide to have a swine flu media event, let alone a real swine flu, if such a thing exists, other than as biowarfare. We're talking about something which could potentially use up a huge amount of time and could be quite a drama. And I think if I could proffer advice about the whole thing, it would be this is a time to really teach yourself how to play Scarlett O'Hara and decide that the drama can occur without you. That doesn't mean we won't have to navigate the situation, but we can make sure it doesn't eat up our time and we decide not to participate in the panic. On my list in the third quarter, two things I wanted to mention. I'm trying to get a local market going here in Hickory Valley. I bought a little meat market that was on the highway, and I'm trying to see if I can get people, gardeners, and people looking to do yard sales, just using it once a week. It's a way to get people together. I was inspired by the town down the road, LaGrange. They have a coffee clutch every Saturday morning, and anybody who wants to come and talk with their neighbors and have coffee can do it. And it's a way to start to get to, you know, just get people together in a way that's practical and useful, but gets them talking about, okay, how can we do more for ourselves here? Another thing on my list to do is, as those of you who listened to the Cliff High interview on the Solari Report or read the Alex Ansari article that I put up on the blog with a big sort of blue Solari gold star, the Earth is going through a part of the rotation in the galaxy, which is shifting the electromagnetic field. And I think we have another couple years of intense changes or pressure in the electromagnetic field, and which could cause real weather issues. I live in a place with incredible tornadoes and storms. They're getting worse. So I hope to learn more about that and, most importantly, how to deal with these changes and whether or not this is one of the things that's causing the leadership to be so jumpy. Anyway, so it sounds like a lot of tough stuff. At the same time, we're going through a separation. I think all of us know the 100 Monkey story. In the 100 Monkey story, six or one monkey starts to wash bananas. It takes a long time for the monkey's mother to start washing a banana. Finally, six monkeys wash a banana, and then all of a sudden, all the monkeys on that island and islands around it are washing bananas. And it's a story of, you know, sort of a shift in the field. And I've spent years now hoping that we could get to the six monkeys, you know, sort of critical mass. And when that happens, we could start to get a shift in the field. Now, this is important because we don't have an economic problem. If you really dig in and look at the economy and what's going on, there's plenty of resources, plenty of technology. There's all sorts of things we can do to build an abundant economy, but we can't do it with this kind of centralized control and sort of nasty economic warfare. So how we get everybody to kind of open their heart and go to a higher level is a, you know, that's a big challenge. But what is important is we're starting to see very talented, responsible people say, hey, something's wrong, we've got to change. And with unemployment, as horrible as it is, we're seeing incredible talent that's been busy, you know, working for defense contractors or whomever, becoming available. And that talent right now is a precious resource, because the reality is the American people are going to have to forge a whole new way of living, and we're going to have to do it without our leadership. And because we're coming into July 4th, I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotes from, I think it was John Adams, who said, he was talking about the Revolutionary War, and he said, you know, the war was not the revolution. The war was the consequence of the revolution. He said the revolution was in the hearts and the minds of the people. And that's what's happening. We're starting to see a revolution in the hearts and minds of the people. And that is an invisible force right now, but it's a very powerful force. And I think it's a force that's going to grow and shift in the third and fourth quarter. And that's what we want to be a part of, because that's where something positive can really come out of it. So that's it for the third quarter. Let me just say a brief minute or two on our Let's Go to the Movies. I said I wanted to comment on the Canadian TV series Intelligence, which is, you know, I don't have a TV, but I do watch DVDs. And it's a Vancouver-based television crime drama that ran in 2006 and 2007 in Canada. And it's just extraordinary. It's just extraordinary. It's available on DVD for those of you who get Netflix. It's available from Netflix. It's the story of one of the top, actually, is a marijuana dealer and sort of crime boss who's also got a shipping company, Jimmy Reardon. And the other protagonist is a woman named Mary Spalding, who's the director of the Vancouver Organized Crime Unit, who gets promoted up to the intelligence agency, the National Intelligence Agency, during the show. And they have a relationship. You see, Jimmy is technically an informant, but what you see is sort of the good guys are not government versus organized crime. There's sort of good and bad running through both. And it shows three things in a very remarkable way. One is how bureaucratic turf wars really work and how they dovetail with the political pressure that's coming down from on high that's insisting that the money work, you know, in a way that generates the high profit margin that organized crimes do. So there's kind of a love-hate relationship between organized crime and the bureaucracy. But they have to learn to live together. So you see how sort of it really does work. And you see it between the national and the state and local bureaucracies. It's quite remarkable. The second thing is it shows you the power and importance of intelligence and inside information and how, you know, winning at economic warfare really comes down to who has the intelligence and information and how they get it. And it's quite clever the way they do it. They put a stress on it and they do a very good job. The third thing, and I suspect it's why the show got canceled, there shows up in the second season a firm, an American firm called Blackmire Group. It's almost a takeoff on Blackstone and Carlyle. And the Blackmire Group is running around Canada and the United States paying off politicians and buying up water rights. And it is so close to what's really going on, particularly up in British Columbia. I mean, I can't even believe they got away with it. And it shows how the various parties sort of compete and protect each other, including implied CIA protection for the Blackmire Group, who's run by a former high-level, I guess it's a deputy, CIA deputy. Anyway, but you kind of see sort of how the game is working, and it's astounding that they got as much onto TV. Occasionally you'll see that coming out of Canada. So if you're kind of interested in how the, you know, sort of the complex web between intelligence and enforcement agencies and organized crime works, it's a really just a wonderful picture of showing that in one place, Vancouver, which, of course, is a beautiful and fun city. So for those of you who are interested, I recommend it. And it's, you know, it's just good entertainment. So Intelligence, available in DVD and from Netflix. Okay, so coming up next week, July 9th, we have the Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders, and that I'm going to be fascinated to be part of because July 8th is when the G8 and the Russian summit ends, so we will know a lot more, hopefully. Our movie will be George Clooney's wonderful thriller, Michael Clayton. Can't recommend it enough for those of you particularly who like adventure and thrillers. On July 23rd, I'm going to be interviewing attorney Alan Phillips, author of Vaccine Legal Exemptions. I've just finished that book, and in the process of determining how I can avoid vaccines if an attempt is made this fall to mandate them, but I thought subscribers would value hearing some of the material in the book and some of what we learn in the process of doing that research. So, again, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have I hope you had as good a second quarter as we did at the Soleri team, in no small part because of the opportunity to serve you, and we want to thank you again for that. We wish you a wonderful July 4th weekend, and July 4th reminds us of the power of positive conspiracies. So don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. So good night and good luck. Have a wonderful July 4th weekend.